Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We continue our deep dive into the family reunification process here in New York. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, urban affairs reporter for WNYC, filling in for Brian Lehrer this morning. Our next guests are Lenny Benson, an NYU law professor and founder of Safe Passage. The organization provides legal representation to young people who attempt to enter the U.S. alone. These kids are known as unaccompanied minors, but recently Safe Passage took over some of the cases of children who didn't come here alone, but who got taken away from their parents at the border. Senior staff attorney Alexandra Rizzio is representing those kids. Lenny, Alexandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
I just have to make one correction.
Sure.
I'm New York Law School, not NYU. We are a separate independent law school.
Okay, thank you for that. Sorry
sure.
about that.
No problem.
And listeners, there is still so much we don't know about the process for reuniting kids with their parents. So if you are a foster parent caring for a child brought here from the U.S. border with Mexico, or if you work at a foster care agency under contract to care for these kids, or if you work for the government, give us a call and share whatever information you have. And if you don't have any direct contact with these families, but as a child you experienced being separated from your parent, call and tell us how that experience affected and shaped you. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So Lenny, let's start with you. You've been doing immigration law since 1994. Have you seen anything like this before?
I've actually been doing immigration law since 1983 when I graduated law school myself. I've been teaching since 1994. I do think we're in an unprecedented time. I guess there's never been this separation of parents and children. That is extraordinary. But we are, I think, similarly experiencing the urgency and the need for the immigration system to catch up with the numbers of people. And we saw that in 2014 when Safe Passage Project began, expanded its work so that we could take on more of the kids' cases.
Okay, and so Lenny, when unaccompanied minors come here, they're typically seeking asylum, correct?
Many remedies. By the way, I've never met a child who, when I ask them why they came to the United States, said to have asylum. They don't answer it that way. They say, my grandmother told me it wasn't safe for me to stay, and I had to go, and my uncle's going to care for me, or my mother was already in the United States. So I think there's many remedies for these children, and we pursue a lot of them. When a child's represented, about 85% of the time there's a positive result. There are many different remedies. When they're not represented, the reverse is true. Very few of them get any ability
immigration
to stay.
It's very complicated.
Yeah.
And so while they're here, and if they are seeking asylum, they are often released to sponsors who have to go through extensive background checks. And it appears that kids who came here not unaccompanied but with their parents were being treated similarly, and in some cases their parents had to go through these same rigorous background checks. Now we understand that that might end today, and there's going to be an announcement on how that process will be streamlined. But let's talk about what is that process.
Well, first of all, when it is a natural legal guardian, like a parent, a natural parent, there did not used to be fingerprinting or extensive background check. Hmm. Children were released very, very quickly. The parent or maybe a grandparent paid for the child's transportation from the border. However, in recent months, the administration has ratcheted up this idea to slow down the release of children. And the NYCLU actually has a lawsuit pending here in New York complaining that the government has put obstacles in the path of children to be released. So they say there's reasons to do it, but I think this is part of the war on immigrants.
Alexandra, how many children are you representing?
Safe Passage Project has taken referrals for about 70 of the over 300 children in the New York area who've been separated from their families.
And 730 more cases before that.
Right.
Got it. And can you tell me a little bit about who these kids are? How old are they? What countries do they come from? Do they know where their parents are?
I can't speak specifically, obviously, to individual clients, but I will say that the ages range from very young to teenagers. Sometimes the children have a sense of where their parents are. Sometimes they don't. They do speak to their parents by phone, but you know, often they really they haven't seen their parents in months, and so the whole process is very disorienting for them. And so our job as child advocates is to come in and try to give them some semblance of stability and to assure them that we are there to advocate for their interests.
Who do they think you are? Do they understand who you are?
That's a great question. I mean, working with Safe Passage Project has represented hundreds of immigrant children over the years. And so we have a process by which we explain who we are to our clients. You know, I like to tell them, you're my boss. I am here to help you do what you want. So you have to tell me, you know, what it is that you want, and I will do my best to make that happen. But they have no sense of the American immigration system. They have no sense. I mean, most, I would say, Americans have never been involved in a court case like this, or needed a legal advocate like this. So you can imagine, for very young kids, it's quite a disorienting experience.
Have you been involved in a reunification yet?
We are working on it. We have. I should note that the government is counting as reunification. First of all, if a child is reunified with a parent. Second of all, if the child is released to a blood relative. And third of all, if the child is released to a non-blood relative. So there have been instances where a child has, quote unquote, reunified with a non-blood relative, but it's more complicated to get them back with their biological parent.
I see. Okay.
The countries, by the way, are the Northern Triangle mm-hmm. countries, primarily Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, three of the most dangerous countries in the world. Honduras has the highest murder rate of women and girls in the world, and Honduras and El Salvador are listed by the UN as in the top five countries, more dangerous than war zones.
And what is the rate of success when it comes to applying for asylum?
Well, there's a multi-leveled process, so I have to tell you there's different success rates at different stages. With children who are unaccompanied, they are given the right to first go to the asylum office. The New York office, sadly, only has a 27% approval rate. And I say sadly because I think often that is pressure from within the USCIS to be very narrow in the scope of protection.
And it's dropped.
And it's dropped.
Yeah, we've reported on that this year.
That's great. And I have some FOIAs pending. I haven't gotten the answers back yet from the agency.
That's press speak for Freedom of Information request.
Thank you.
Lenny does a lot of that.
In the immigration court, where a child can renew the application if it's not approved by the asylum office, it's still early days to report on the success because, as you may know, courts are very busy. New York is the biggest court in the country. It has, I believe, close to 90,000 cases pending now. Last time I looked, about 15,000 of those were children's cases. So we don't really have all the outcomes. I can tell you Safe Passage Project success rate is much higher than that because our kids are well represented by both pro bono lawyers and staff attorneys.
And Alexandra, how do these kids make the decision whether they want to apply for asylum or whether they, if their parent has been deported, whether they want to go back with their parent?
It's really a case-by-case determination. It's very complicated. This is, as Lenny said, it's really an unprecedented situation. And so our job as advocates at Safe Passage Project is to really help the kids understand all of their options. And help them kind of do a decision tree and say, you know, if this happens, what would you like to have happen for yourself? If that happens, what would you, you know, like to accomplish? Oftentimes, it's dependent on their parent's case. So if a parent is deported, a young child is likely to say, I want to go back home with
sure.
my parent. Unfortunately, many times the parents are the ones who have the information about the kids asylum claim or other types of claims. And so the entire legal representation process is made more complicated by the fact that the parent and the child are not together. And I'm sure that's by design.
Often parents have protected children from the reason they left. They've shielded them from the death threats made directly to the children. I just spent a week in the detention center in South Texas where moms and kids are still together. And every prep interview I did or interview, we had to separate the child from the mom so that she would tell me the truth. Mm-hmm. And she said, I don't want my daughter to know that they said, we will cut you up and put you in a bag. And she's already traumatized by this journey. I don't want her to know why they're using her to get at me to do something that I don't want to do. Older children can sometimes articulate this, but Safe Passage Project's going to have a lot of children who are, you know, quite young. And so we will be busy locating relatives, interviewing them, trying to find out the context of their claim. Many of these people are very poor people in remote regions of countries where maybe one person in the town or two people have cell phones. So representation's challenging.
So these are very serious conditions that they're fleeing.
Absolutely.
And you said that in Texas, when mm-hmm. you were there recently, the kids and parents were together.
That is the only large detention facility the federal government has. There should be no children there. The federal court has said several times this is not a licensed child facility, and you should not be detaining children there. But there's room for 2,400 women and children, and they're held in Dilley, Texas, which is 75 miles southeast of San Antonio. It's a deserty kind of environment with trailers. I was only allowed to see the trailer that is a courtroom with no judge but a TV screen, the trailer that is the asylum office, which are cubicles, and the trailer, which is the visitation area where the moms and kids could come to get consults from lawyers that are volunteering.
I see. And are there a lot of lawyers volunteering?
There's almost too many. It's fantastic. So for the audience that's listening, I just want to say they can get involved by going to immigrationjustice.us. That's a registration site created by a number of coalition groups for lawyers to get training and to volunteer for a lot of projects, and also Safe Passage Project.
I just have a quick question, because a few weeks ago, the Trump administration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, issued his own ruling,
yes,
where he said that if you're fleeing domestic violence, you don't qualify for asylum. And the same thing for, you know, if this could also apply for people fleeing from gangs. It's much harder to get asylum now, is what the government is implementing these new rules. So how does that affect these clients?
The ones in Texas.
Or all these families who are coming to the border now claiming asylum, what's going to happen to them? They're affected now by this new change. So when Cindy says, you know, how many are going to get asylum, you're talking about in the past. This is a new landscape now where they're going by different standards for granting asylum.
So we're going to divide and conquer this question, Beth, because it has a lot of law in it. I'm going to do the law professor thing in a minute. But Alex just wrote a practice advisory on why this decision does not foreclose asylum claims. So maybe, Alex, do you want to take it on?
Sure. So it is true that the Attorney General is trying to foreclose asylum claims to many groups of people. Survivors of severe gender-based violence, probably children who are victims of severe abuse. He's trying to foreclose these claims by way of this decision called Matter of AB. But really all that Matter of AB says is Ms. AB does not qualify for asylum. And the specific ground that she had used that had previously been good law for asylum is no longer good law.
Yeah, but he also says that if you're fleeing, we want to make sure that you couldn't have gone to another part of the country first before coming to the U.S. So there's a huge hurdle there for you guys now.
That's always
in
been
fighting for asylum. So how much is that going to change things for all of this new surge of people who are now, you know, in detention, separated from their kids? They have to get back with their kids, and then they have to pursue an asylum claim. Is that going to be tougher than ever now?
I think practically, yes, it is going to be tougher. What the Attorney General did, however, was simply restate existing law. Those elements that you're talking about, that they can't have been able to resettle in a different area of the country, that their government had to be unwilling or unable to protect them, that is all established asylum law that any immigration lawyer would say, you know, that's always been on the books. So he's simply reiterating it. However, how an immigration judge is going to interpret this new guidance could be to say, well, the Attorney General is telling me I need to hold this to an even stricter standard now, and I will do so.
And those judges work for the U.S. Attorney General.
Exactly. It's all under the Department of Justice. And so they are, while ostensibly independent adjudicators, in reality, I agree with you that we are going to see tightening of the way that these applications are adjudicated.
So I just want to jump in that there were more than 500 pages of a friend of the court brief submitted in that case, and there was a 15-year development of law to protect gender-based claims. There's a lot of what we call dicta, or just extra words, in that opinion. And the way our U.S. judicial system works, the rule of law works, is that the federal circuit courts ultimately control in your area, your jurisdiction. So when we were in Texas, we were writing legal briefs, staying up all night, you know, writing legal briefs to the asylum officers to say, there is good law protecting this particular case in this circuit and this circuit and this circuit, et cetera. The Attorney General can't, with one simple decision, rewrite decades of development of the law.
So I'm just going to jump in here real quick because we do want to hear from listeners. So listeners, once again, if you have had contact with any of these families, please give us a call. If you haven't, but you at one point in your life were separated from your parents, call and tell us how that experience affected and shaped you. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, Urban Affairs reporter at WNYC, filling in for Brian Lehr, and I'm here with WNYC reporter Beth Fertig and Lenny Benson and Alexandra Rizzio from Safe Passage, talking about the legal hurdles to family reunification and also asylum. So let's get back to these children and the separated families for a minute. So the government says it needs to take precautions to make certain that kids are going back to their actual parents and that they're not going back to smugglers or anyone else that can harm them. And there are laws that require a certain amount of vetting of parents, as I understand it. Is there a way to do this without further traumatizing kids and keeping them away from their parents for so long?
The federal government is using a standard before they're released to these children that no family court would use. There is a presumption in international law and state law, and normally family court issues of reunification with a parent is a state law issue, but it's right. A different context here, that the natural parent of a child, if you have any evidence that they are the parent, is the presumptive place the child should be. And then there's a lot of investigation and careful assessment of, is it dangerous? Here, the federal government has just turned the law on its head and putting the burden on these parents to prove that they're parents. So we've heard about DNA testing, for example, which it is true the U.S. Immigration Service does use if you're bringing someone from overseas to make sure that the refugee that's being admitted, these are all the intimate family. Or sometimes in a marriage case, if we're talking about stepchildren that qualify, because people sometimes will have informal adoptions. So mm-hmm. the Immigration Service is right. used to doing that in that context. But in this context, where they created the crisis, where they separated the children and family, to me, they are way out of line and not doing what any family court judge would do.
And my experience has been I just want to highlight how careless the original separation process was. There's no record keeping. Immigrants are assigned what are called A numbers, alien numbers, upon their first contact with immigration authorities.
Right.
So usually if there's a parent and child, they'll be assigned sequential A numbers. And it would make it easier to locate, for example, a parent if we knew the child's A number. We're finding that not the A numbers are not sequential. We can't locate the parent because there's simply no record keeping. So the idea that now is the time to use extremely stringent processes, DNA tests that take weeks. The damage is done and it's ongoing. So, you know, our goal at Safe Passage Project is to advocate for the reunification of kids as quickly as possible if that's what the child wants. But to be honest, I mean, the way that the separation originally happened is making that quite difficult. And as Lenny said, it's sort of an absurd proposition to put the burden now on parents.
So, Alexandra.
And there's no database we can just look into.
Right.
People should not imagine we can just log into some court system and find mom or dad. We can't. ICE, however, can. And in recent court hearing where Alex was there, she could tell you the story. ICE is acting like they cannot assist the lawyers for the children. And this is outrageous to me.
Hmm. Okay, and so this is a good time to bring in a caller. Her name is Anne Marie Mulcahy, and she's from the Vera Institute of Justice, and she runs something called the Immigrant Connection Project.
She's an expert.
Anne Marie, are you there?
Hi, yes, Cindy, I'm here.
So you just heard these attorneys talking about how difficult, how bad the record keeping is. Well, first let's explain to listeners, tell us what the Immigrant Connection Project is.
Sure, the Immigrant Connection Project, or ICON as we call it, is a way for parents or attorneys working with parents or other family members working with parents to contact us either through a phone call or through email currently to let us know that they're looking for a particular child. We at Vera, we run a network of legal service providers who are working directly with the children in or our custody. They provide Know Your Rights presentations and legal screenings to all of the children in or our custody. And so what happens is if a parent reaches out or an attorney reaches out seeking information about a particular child, we can check our program information and find out which legal services provider conducted the legal screening for that child. Mm-hmm. And then we can provide, you know, two-way information there, right? So we would then report back to the parent or the inquirer that we believe that that child is working with this legal services organization, and here's the contact information. At the same time, we reach out immediately to our legal services provider, and we say that the parent or an attorney working with the parent has reached out seeking information about this child, and we provide the legal service provider with both the contact person's information and the location of the parent and, you know, parent date of birth, a number, if that information has also been provided.
Okay. So it is very remarkable to me that kids are showing up. I mean, I imagined that you would show up with a case file that would clearly document where you entered, where your parents are at, where you're at, and I imagined that the parents would be given the same sort of records.
But they're also moving the parents about. So you can look in something called the ICE locator if you know the A number, but that doesn't get updated every hour. Mm-hmm. And you might have been detained in Port Isabel, Texas, and now you're up in Albany County mm-hmm. Jail. You are aware there's 300 men and women that have been moved from the border here mm-hmm. to New York. There's the New York Immigration Coalition is mobilized with Albany Law School and some other volunteers, including Claire Thomas from New York Law School, to try to help those families. They're no different than the people who are being held in Texas.
Sure. And Anne-Marie, just to make clear, your database is a database of children. It is not a database of parents.
That's correct.
And it's important to note, I mean, these databases are incredibly important and useful, but they are the work of nonprofit advocates who have scrambled and said it's our moral responsibility to do our best to connect these families that have been separated. This is not the action of the government to correct their own wrongs. This is nonprofit legal services providers coming together and doing our best to rapidly right a very severe wrong.
Good point.
And I just want to add, you mentioned, Lenny, that the parents move around a lot. I've heard this consistently from so many people who have dealt with the parents that they bounce around different ICE detention centers. In fact, the ones, two who came yesterday, two dads who got their four-year-old sons, they wound up in New Jersey because you know, they were going to be expecting to reconnect with kids in New York. But before that, they had bounced around like three different states, I think. And this is not uncommon.
And not at their request.
Right.
You should be clear.
And why does that happen? Why don't you just stay in one detention center? Why does ICE move you with Jenny Gonzalez-Garcia? She was kept in a processing center, two different processing centers, for 3 weeks before she moved to a detention center.
So it's a very confusing bureaucracy. Parents are in one bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security. Kids are in a different bureaucracy of Health and Human Services. Right. And it gets very confusing when records are not kept accurately. Anne-Marie, if you're still there, can you tell us how would a parent know to even reach you? And how many parents have reached you?
So when we first launched ICON, we actually reached out to all of the federal public defenders who would be encountering parents in the criminal justice system, as well as to a variety of networks of legal services providers, because there are so many people right now working at the border to at least start with getting the word out to any attorneys that might be encountering the parents. We do have a call, a toll-free number that's 800-845-8372 that anybody can call between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. We have that staffed. We were also able to set up a number within the Department of Homeland Security detention facilities, on their free calling system. So for people who are in ICE custody, they can dial 621-POUND and get straight through to our hotline number. And then we have an email that, again, would be mostly attorneys that would use familyconnect@vera.org or familiasunidas@vera.org. They both come through to the same. And we've also made outreach with consulates and the ICRC, American Red Cross, because, of course, and I know you've already spoken about this somewhat, some of the parents have already been deported, and so they're, back in Central America,
right,
and still trying to connect or find who to speak with about their children.
Can you give us any numbers? How many parents have called? How many connections have you been able to make?
I don't have all of the numbers in front of me right now. We are going to try to release those numbers shortly, but I can say that we've been making matches. In fact, matched a majority of the inquiries that we've received.
Okay. Thank you very much, Anne-Marie, for joining us. We have another caller on the line, Marsha from Queens. Marsha, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Marsha, you're on the air. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I have a concern about some boys who have been placed in a foster care situation who I met in school, and I sub sometimes now, during this term, and those boys told me, the few that I spoke with who were in my class that day, that they are not getting enough food where they are staying, and they were very thin. And I know that teenagers can be thin sometimes if they're active, but they seemed very hungry, and they asked me if they could get lunch downstairs. And they have lunch provided for them, but they were still hungry. So I allowed them to go down, and they came back. They didn't stay long. They did go to lunch. And it was explained to me, too, by one of the boys that it's very uncomfortable where they stay. They're not with their parents. The one I spoke with was a happier one. Others that were in the class that day were scared. Mm-hmm. And they expressed that they were, well, the one that I spoke with said that his mother was in India, and he came through Mexico to get here, and he came alone. Mm. And I said, how did you do that? And he didn't want to talk about it because there were other boys who were looking at him from that group.
I see.
And there seemed to be a leader in the group who was rather bullish, a bully, and one of the boys in particular in that class that day, from the 20 that he told me are in his home, in the group home.
Marsha, do you have a sense of whether these are boys who came alone Yes, they did. They did come alone. And our two attorneys here.
Well, I don't know about all of them. I know the one that I spoke with that he did. He said he came alone.
Okay. And I just want to put the question out to our two attorneys. Have either of you? Well, first of all, do you know how foster families get vetted, and have you heard any other complaints?
So this word foster care is bothering me because it's the system of placing children in licensed foster facilities doesn't make it foster care. So contrast a child here in Brooklyn or Manhattan that needs foster care. There's going to be a family judge involved, social workers appointed,
right.
A lot of care and vetting. And it does take a long time to get licensed to be a foster facility. And even then, we know sometimes our city government has problems with care and taking
sure.
care of. This federal system is much less sophisticated, and there's no monitoring. The immigration judge is not a family court judge. She has no social workers, no staff to go out and check those placements. So it really falls on Health and Human Services and their division to keep checking the quality of these licensed facilities, and I think they do try. And so if any children are listening and there are problems, they should try to reach out to school social workers or to attorneys if they have them. But I want to say that there's a growing number of children here who have no attorney, which is why I founded the Safe Passage Project, because you're not entitled under federal law to be appointed counsel, unlike what would happen if you were in a state situation. So I know everyone uses this word foster facility or foster parent.
Right, federal foster care, I think, is what.
There's some limited federal foster care, but this most of what we're talking about here is temporary detained placement, sometimes in foster homes, but it's not full foster care.
Okay. Alexandra, have any of your clients complained about where they're staying?
We have had very good experiences with the Department of Health and Human Services and their contractors. So I am, in general, very confident that the kids are receiving good care. But of course, part of our role as advocates is to let our clients know if there are problems. You know, please tell us. That's part of our job, is to ensure that they are in a safe situation. So, I can't speak to the caller's specific story. I hope that those kids will ultimately be appointed counsel and will feel comfortable, or perhaps the caller would feel comfortable going to the school social worker so that an intervention can be made. But, as Lenny said, part of the reason that it's so important that children, whether accompanied, whether unaccompanied minors, or children who have been separated from their families, have dedicated legal advocates, is to ensure that they remain in a safe home environment.
So, ladies, we have to end it here. This is a very fluid situation. Thank you both so much for coming on and giving us all of your knowledge. I'm sure you'll continue to watch this, and please keep us up to date how your clients are doing. Lenny Benson is a professor of immigration law at the New York Law School and founder of their Safe Passage Project. The organization provides legal representation to both unaccompanied minors and kids separated from their parents at the border. Alexandra Rizzio is a senior staff attorney. Thanks to you both for shedding some light on what's happening.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.